There we go. And that just leaves me to introduce David, who's here to share with us today. Really pleased that he's come along to tell us about his 26 years in sobriety. The floor is yours, David. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jen. I actually, it's yourself and Emma. Really, congratulations, like to 6 months in a year. Well done. I honestly don't know what I'm going to talk about, but the only thing is to say this is the best thing I've ever done in my life. My life really has been in different portions. I had a particular life before the 26th of January 1999, and it fell apart on the 23rd of January 1999, and I began a journey into a different way of life on the 26th. And to lead a life of drinking drugs, but also what was behind the drinking drugs, the type of person I was. And I suppose I want to focus, it's what I'm dealing with now, and what I'm dealing with now, in a way, to give a bit of context, is I go back 3 years, and 3 years ago, my life was, it was wonderful. I was really reaping the benefits of long-term sobriety. The love of my second marriage, my first marriage, my drinking and drugging destroyed, even though now I'm very good friends with my first wife. She's a good support. I had found and fell in love with a wonderful woman. We had gotten married. She really helped me when my son died 17 years ago at the age of 24. And then we had gone and we were going to create a new life for ourselves in Australia, and Nikki's mum died, and she asked me, would I go help her look after her dad? And I said, girl, you had my back, now it's my turn to have yours. Where you go, I go. We're a team. This is how we work. And we set up home in the UK, and we got married. I had a job. We were, focusing on, okay, quite soon we're going to go on our next adventure. We were seriously contemplating going to Australia and New Zealand, particularly New Zealand. And then, this was in May. I go on my long distance walks. I fall in the Lake District. I have a double break of my ankle. I'm on the top of a mountain in horrendous conditions, really wondering, am I going to get out of this alive? And the worst thing I have to think about is, okay, I have to accept I'm in serious trouble here. Can I crawl my way down the mountain if I have to? And I thought, that's what I have to do. If that's what I have to do, that's what I have to do. But lucky enough, people came my way about an hour later, and I got through that particular, and the rescue team arrived then about 4 hours later, and I was rescued off the mountain. So a double break, surgery, followed the instructions after the surgery. My work was good. They paid me for the 3 months I was out. Nikki is looking at having a hysterectomy. She thinks this might solve her tiredness. The surgeon comes back and says, there's something there. Get it checked. We get it checked. It's stage four bowel tumor. Suddenly, this grenade has gone off. And it's like, okay, what does that mean? Well, at the moment, the tumor is too big, so chemotherapy, shrink the tumor, we remove it, colostomy bag, 2 years. Okay, let's work on that. Let's get tracking on that. What do I need to do? I can't, I'm walking away from work. Nikki and myself were also beekeepers. I can't keep my bees. I need to keep my bees away. I need to keep all my beekeeping away, equipment away. I have to focus on what's in front of me. I have to accept the reality of what's happening now. and what's happening with Nikki, and I have to walk with her till her death. And I don't have the language to describe what I felt like. You know, devastation, anguish, and I said, okay, this is a tough walk here. This is the other side of sobriety. This is when the shit hits the fan. What's the plan, Dave? You do and deal with what's in front of you, Dave, and you put one foot in front of the other, and you do the best you can for the people you love and care for that you've made a life The key, the treatment was shocking for Nikki. She was so brave with the first chemotherapy. Very quickly afterwards, she's threatening a heart attack. The chemo has such an effect on her. 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm trying to get an ambulance. There are no ambulances at 3 o'clock on a Saturday morning in Bath. I have to try and get Nikki in. I don't drive. I have to try and get Nikki in. We manage it. She's been prepped for open heart surgery. And eventually they managed to stabilize her. Later on, she did go for a bit. She had a collapse, and they brought her, they revived her. This huge team arrives in with fucking paddle boards and the electronic stuff. And second hospitalization after the second chemo was outrageously high temperature, very dangerous. Consultation, they decide we're going to change the chemo suite of drugs by chemo six and the review. This isn't working. The metastasis has spread not only to the other organs, but also to the brain. What's the story here now? You know, at one point I was looking, we were looking at 2 years. If you're lucky, you get 6 months. This is Christmas of 22. Nikki died in June of 23. So, we managed because our official anniversary was Valentine's Day, and I booked this luxury spa hotel. It was an amazing room. I'd never seen a room like it. It was a lord's room, and the front of the room was curved with three windows, and the corresponding opposite wall was curved with three doors. The wood was curved. This monster bed. There was balloons decked out. There was chocolates waiting. There was two huge bats. This is why I booked the room. In the front section, looking out over this huge lawn. The two of us having bats in the afternoon, these luxury spa bats. And we had this moment of thought, if I could extend this moment beyond this time, you know? This is the best Nikki has been in the last 7 months. And I thought maybe we get a bit longer, but then very quickly afterwards, she begins to deteriorate. And at one point, I was left wondering, because of the level of pain she was in, even without the pain management, what do I do if Nikki asks me to end it for her? Could I do it? And how would I do it? Now, this is something you don't, you know, I'm trying to be real here. This is something that was very, who do you talk about stuff like this to? And throughout that journey, every time there was engagement with the medical profession, with doctors, with our local surgery, at one point I needed to get extra medication for the words. I didn't like the response. I challenged the response. And as a result of that challenge, they changed their procedure for how they deal in future with people in terminal illness. A whole new regime came in. And I didn't go banging and roaring and shouting at them. That doesn't solve anything, even though that's how I felt I wanted to do. But I simply said, you know, there's the CQC can get involved here, which is the Quality Care Commission. These guys are serious. If they come in to investigate you, no medical practice wants to see this. But it worked. And it was, this is not about me. This is about other people now who may find themselves in this position. The last week, Nikki was in a hospice. And again, I thought we'd get a few weeks. But again, I got it wrong. And within 2 days of being there, her pain, her distress was so much, she was on medication to relieve that. But basically, she wasn't conscious. Then, on her last breath, the reality sets in. I've lost the love of my life. What am I going to do now? Where do I go? What happens to me? And difficulties have began to emerge with Nikki's family. I was living in the house. I thought, look, I'll just get out of there. I'll go away for a week. I came back. Our bedroom was gone. I was in another bedroom. And then I was told I had to find a mattress on the floor. Her brother was now in charge. And I reacted. I got very angry. And then I realized I was at a very dangerous place because I had this murderous rage and it wasn't safe. And it's not anybody's fault. I owned it. I went back. I apologized for raising my voice. I didn't apologize for what I said. And then I went to some friends and they put me up and they kept me then. That was in the beginning of July and I stayed with my friends till November. I didn't go back to the house. I sought advice. I had a long-term therapist. I had other people. I needed to go back and get stuff. I was told if you want anything from this house, you produce receipts to prove your ownership. And when I did get in to collect some stuff, I was only allowed a 1 hour window to do it. And afterwards, then I was told not to come back. I wasn't welcome. If I called again, I'd be asked to leave. So, you know, I'm looking at what's going on here. I've just, this is crazy. This is absolutely crazy. And I had this very strong feeling that what was going on had the power to destroy me if I wasn't careful. Now, I wasn't, there was never a moment that I wanted a drink or a drug or any medication or anything to take me away from reality. My 2 feet were on the ground. I had long-term sobriety. I understood the world is the way it is. Things are the way they are. I accept that. If there's something I don't like, what am I going to do to change it? There's nothing I can do to change any of this. But what do I need to do? I need to get someplace safe. I need to get people who will show me love. This family showed me love. Their youngest boy, Arlo, we became buddies. We took on gardening projects. Every morning I'd come down, he had his own little wheelbarrow. He had his own little gloves. He loved being in the garden digging. He just wanted a buddy. He said, Dave, got him. He wanted to be in the garden with me. He just, you know, like that. Imagine being given that, you know, I think it's the love of a child. It's totally unconditional. And this was I saw it. This is the gift I'm getting. You know, I'm dealing with utter heartache, and at the same time, a child has given me this gift of his love. And the family looked after me, and I came back to Ireland. The house was empty. I decided I had to rebuild a life, and everything I had pushed aside, once I came back here and started to settle down, came flooding in. And I had this murderous rage. Maybe you might have heard me talking a year ago, Jen, what I was going to do to my brother-in-law. I had so much anger. And I also had huge amount of fears, the resentments. I ended up with huge resentments towards certain people, AA people in Galway. When I told them of Nicky's death, oh, God's will, we're all on borrowed time. You'll have more time for your granddaughters. And some people didn't know how to. They said nothing. And how would I describe it? It's like two circles, a small one and a big one. And this big circle is grief, and the small circle is life. And I'm in grief, and suddenly life drags me out, and I'm in life. And then I'm dragged back into my grief, back into life, back and forth. And it's this schizophrenic, frantic movement between one and the other. And then if I'm in my grief, I'm in this huge anger. And now I'm trying to get beneath the anger. And I learned, I looked at the literature. I went to every place I could. I went to my sponsor. I asked him about what the fuck's going on here. Well, why are people like this? I came back to Galway. I had two brothers who wouldn't even commiserate with me. I said, "Is the whole fucking world gone mad?" "Oh, hang on, Dave, it's you. You know the old message? You're the fuck up. You're wrong. You're getting this because you deserve it. You're not good enough." That's my fucking alcoholism. That's the taproot that goes right back into my childhood. From the earliest time I can remember, I was told I was wrong. I had a church that told me I was wrong, that I actually had to be baptized for original sin. I was born wrong. And then I come across all these kind of authority types who had a lot to do with education, and they're psychopaths. I don't know from one day to the other how safe my world is, whether one of these adults will turn on me. So I had huge fear, and then the fear had to be suppressed, and I internalized that fear because I thought, is it me or is it them? And of course, as a child, no child is going to say, "Oh, it's them. I'm the one that's okay." A child is going to say, "No, I'm the one that's wrong." I internalized it. And I was introduced to alcohol because, so one pint prescribed a glass of Guinness because I had an iron deficiency. So at 7 or 8, I was having a weekly glass of Guinness with my father. I was 12, 13, the first time I got drunk. By 15, I was sitting in bars. I was in the man's world. I was accepted. 16, I was doing drugs. 18, I was full-time addict. I think no, whatever about something else is going on here. What do I do? Because I have all, I still stay close to my AA. I still stay close to my home group. I'm still working with other alcoholics. COVID brought about a rejuvenation of my recovery because I got introduced to Geoffrey Munn and his approach with the 12 steps, which I really like and I take into. But inside of me, there is huge conflict. I'm not sleeping. What has just happened here? My life is utterly altered. Where do I go? What sense can I make of this? And I didn't find anything. I didn't find anything in the literature. I thought, okay, this I do know. I was in trouble before and I reached out for help. That's why I went to AA. I went to my doctor first. I'm in trouble here with this. I have to reach out. I need to get support. I need to get my scaffolding in place. Now I have something else to deal with. And in a way, the grief is, you know, if you could imagine a box and you blow up a balloon and you stuff that balloon into the box, that's grief. It's just the little edges where the balloon doesn't touch in the corners. That's the rest of life. And inside that balloon then is all the subcomponents. And I have to deal with this. I have to accept it's there. The anger is there. Whatever happened, it's there. It's all there. I can't change any of it with my mind. I can't do anything with this. But I don't want to live like that. The grief is going to be my companion. My life is utter, the same as the first day I walked into an AA meeting, my life changed. Now my life has changed again. My life will never be the same again. Grief is going to be my constant companion. I had that after my son died. Now it's back because just recently my mum died. And I got grief support network, but I also came across something. I was searching and searching. I came across this: gain and victory to others, loss and defeat to myself. Wow, the fuck? What does that mean? And it's a Tibetan Buddhist, and it's not that I lie down and allow people to walk on me and take what they want. But trying to move to deal with my anger, to deal with my resentments with curiosity and kindness. How do I do that? Well, this statement became the doorway for me to get. For me to venture in here. I was never much for meditation. I took to the meditation last year. I get up each morning, there's a meditation group. The idea that I can somehow try and settle my mind with my breath, the same as I can ease a muscle when I'm in my yoga class and I feel that stiffness and tightness, that I can use my breath to help soften. I can feel my body relaxing. I can feel my mind relaxing. All the thoughts keep flooding in, but suddenly I'm beginning to step a little bit each day away from them. I'm not attaching to the thoughts. I'm trying to observe them. I'm not now attaching to my anger. I'm trying to observe it. And if others, and there was other stuff that I lost things, I lost stuff. But the biggest thing is I lost Nikki. There's a vacancy, there's an absence. There's a loss of a future I thought I was going to have. And now I have to get up each day. Even after getting that feeling, I'm losing Nikki again. Each time I wake up, I get that feeling I'm losing her again. Now I have to find a reason for living today. And in all the pain, the agony and the pain, where's the joy? What can I be grateful for? My little gratitude list. What can I be grateful? Can I be grateful for that cup of coffee? Can I feel the gratitude of having my own home where I'm warm and safe? And I got this really nice cup of coffee because I bought these really expensive coffee beans and I made myself a cup of coffee and I love my cup of coffee. and that's my anchor. Or I soak my porridge the night before. Because that brings me into tomorrow. That's the promise for tomorrow. I give myself, I'm going to be here tomorrow. I prepare my porridge for the morning. And like tonight, people are from all over the world, from different countries, different continents. And you're consistent. I see your faces regularly. I'm not alone, even though I'm on my own. And it's the same with my morning meditation group and my grief group. I've called it my elder living group. I became involved with my local community. It's an over 65 group. I'm a senior now. I'm going to be an OAP this year. An old age pensioner. Now, I never thought I'd get this far. I had 16 lovely years with Nikki. We had huge adventures. We had a great time together. We loved each other. I'm blessed in the sense that I had the opportunity because of sobriety. That I had a relationship with another human being, deep, lasting relationship. That I was accepted and loved for who I was. And that person never saw me or experienced me or had to try and deal with me like my first wife did, trying to escape from reality. That's why I'm here. I tried for nearly 40 years, I wanted to escape from reality. It didn't work. That's why I like Leonard Cohen when he says, everything has a crack. That's how the light gets in. So I think I have talked way too long and I'm starting to get emotional anyway. So listen, thank you so much for asking me, Jen, and everybody for being here.